We have a large group of children here with various medical conditions. They've had cancer and are getting chemo. They've had a transplant and are on an immunosuppressive medicine. They might have inflammatory bowel disease or something else where they're on a variety of medicines to suppress their immune system to control their symptoms. Those kids deserve to travel. They want to travel. They want to live a normal life.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice.
Welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. We have a returning guest today, someone whose last episode broke all of our streaming records, and more importantly, provided some absolutely crucial information to our listeners about vaccines. A lot has happened in the world of infectious disease since he and I last spoke. And if you've been following the news lately, you know there is a lot to unpack. Today, we're talking about the viruses making international headlines, which we know are very much on people's minds as they start embarking on summer travel. We'll also cover any and all recent information and guidelines about vaccines. Dr. Ravi Javeri is the head of infectious disease at Lurie Children's Hospital. And if you caught the first appearance on the show, you'll know he is good at making complex medical topics feel manageable. Dr. Ravi, welcome back. We're so happy to have you.
Thanks, Dr. Sarah. It's great to be back.
Well, the last time we spoke, we talked a lot about the changes to the childhood vaccine schedule. What's the latest? Is there anything parents should know that's changed or shifted since then?
There has been, on the policy front and the legal front, some changes regarding the stay to some of the recommendations by the ACIP that was appointed by RFK Jr. The administration is appealing that stay, and so the legal drama is continuing. But from a vaccination recommendation standpoint, those recommendations from the AAP have not changed.
A lot of pediatric organizations are worried about certain vaccines being deprioritized. For example, maybe some parents will get their kids vaccinated against the most life-threatening illnesses, but then not others. We're seeing measles cases rising. Does that seem connected to vaccine hesitancy or considering other vaccines of lesser importance? How worried should parents be about this measles outbreaks that we're seeing, and what can they do?
So measles is an example where even a small slip in the vaccine rates, because it's such a contagious virus, really does make a difference. And if those individuals tend to live in clusters in a community, that's really what drives the outbreaks like we saw last year in Texas and New Mexico, or perhaps earlier this year in South Carolina. And increasingly, we see that measles finds those pockets of people who have decided to pause or halt or delay vaccination. And so that's a really great example of how even just a small drop in rates can have a huge impact.
I remember, Dr. Ravi, early in my residency, seeing measles. And then now, in the last 30 years, I'm grateful that I haven't seen it since. And that is because of vaccinations. And it is worrisome to me that they're going to consider others also as not as important, such as hepatitis B, which you and I talked about the last time. What's interesting to me is that a lot of families are thinking, well, I don't need to worry about measles because we don't really see it in our community, or I haven't seen chickenpox in years. Let's talk a little bit about that, because when somebody feels like it's not a threat, they're less likely to be active in prevention.
Yeah, this is very true. I think in some ways we're the victims of all the success from vaccines because people have forgotten, don't have that memory of the worst cases. And I think You and I perhaps trained in a similar era, and so I do remember cases of measles and chickenpox and RSV and rotavirus and our hospital being relatively full of kids that had really severe cases. And so we don't see those cases much anymore. And so I think it's the forgetting that burden and the severe complications has sort of led us to this point. I think it's up to us to have a discussion with our patients about the worst of those. And certainly, you know, I think there's quite a bit of storytelling that can be done. We've tried to enlist families who are comfortable telling their stories, who may have delayed or foregone certain vaccines, and their kids have ended up contracting vaccine preventable illness, to talk about that experience, to remind others that these are still out there. And I think it's the, you know, the analogy I might use is something like, if you do have an intact roof in your house, you're not going to feel it when it's raining really hard, right? And that doesn't mean that it's not raining, or that it's the threat isn't still there. Once you take that roof away, or you go from a nice sturdy roof to something that's not as sturdy, the risk all of a sudden comes back. And so I think we have to sort of change the framing of how we discuss these bacteria and viruses that are out there, that the threat is still there, and we have to be vigilant about you know, our efforts to continue to provide vaccines.
I really like the analogy of the roof, because we don't look at our roof all the time and we don't see it. So just like these preventable illnesses, the vaccines are keeping us safe. So thank you. And I appreciate you emphasizing the importance of that. Now, we'd be remiss not to address the Ebola outbreak that's currently in the news. For parents and families who are hearing about this, how concerned should the average person in the U.S. be?
I think the risk to the average person in the U.S. is exceptionally low. That being said, I think there are some sort of prudent health, public health steps that have been taken. We are more awareness of the local situation in Africa is really helpful on a global perspective. I just received word today that one of the tangible steps we're taking in the U.S. is that any flight coming from the outbreak area now will just be diverted to one airport, which is Dulles in Washington, D.C. And at that time, there'll be what we call symptom screening, where people will be asked about if they have any symptoms consistent with possible Ebola. And then if that is the case, those patients will be placed on some kind of quarantine until proper testing or clearance can happen. And so I think that's going to avoid some of the local outbreaks and cases that we had. If people remember 12 years ago when we had the Ebola outbreak in West Africa back in 2014 into 2015, and we had some cases, let's say in Dallas, where we had people entering the country after traveling in a variety of different places. So these are hard lessons learned about how to potentially manage things. But I think these steps, coupled with the fact that, you know, a place like the DRC is not the most heavily traveled place, and so it's not likely to touch many Americans overall.
I appreciate the reassurance. What are the symptoms someone should be watching for? And at what point should it prompt a call to their doctor?
So after traveling to the appropriate area or being exposed to someone who may have had meaningful travel or exposure in one of the outbreak areas, patients can present with sort of what might be a severe flu-like illness with persistent fever. The early symptoms tend to be mostly gastrointestinal, so vomiting, diarrhea. As it progresses, you start to have signs of shock and bleeding that are sort of the cardinal signs of what we think about the scariest stories of Ebola.
For families who are traveling internationally, whether it's for work or for leisure, what's some practical advice for staying healthy when it comes to something as dangerous as Ebola? Are there precautions they should be taking?
Well, certainly they can first make themselves aware about any local cases or burden that might happen that might have come from travelers. So if you're traveling to a country in Europe, just wanting to know what kind of screening is happening, they may be asked questions about illness and where they've traveled, and being forthcoming about that you came from the U.S., or if you took a big sort of global trip, being forthcoming about that information. Mm-hmm. Obviously, really rigorous hand washing is always good, always health promoting. It's certainly helpful to potentially wear a mask in an area where you have sort of close quarters and lots of people. And so, for instance, a few months ago, I had to have arthroscopic knee surgery and didn't want to get sick before the surgery, and we were traveling. And so I just wore a mask in and around the airport when I was on the plane, because I knew it would be close quarters with lots of people. And so I think we can all, again, temporarily take those precautions when you're in really close quarters. If you're, you know, hiking out somewhere where there's very few people, you're fine without those additional precautions. But certainly close quarters, lots of people, heavy exposure, that's the time to maybe take those extra steps, whether it's a mask or something else.
If you're looking for more information or clarity as you're navigating today's topic, check out our description box below, where we'll share resources to help guide you through these moments. And please like and share this episode with others so they can access this useful conversation as well. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel so you can get those two new episodes each month. Okay. Let's talk about cruises, because this is very much front of mind for lots of families right now who are planning upcoming trips. There have been significant outbreaks of a handful of illnesses on cruise ships lately. Can you give us the lay of the land? What's actually been happening out there?
Yeah, so I think when you mention cruise ships in the current era, I think people are thinking about the recent hantavirus outbreak. And yeah. I just want to emphasize, this is really an anomaly. This is not your usual cruise outbreak. But that being said, it speaks to some of the unique risk factors when you're on a cruise. I was just talking about sort of close quarters, lots of people in a relatively small area, lots of frequent contact. And so those conditions are really almost ideal for a really transmissible agent, either via some respiratory pathway like we saw in the early days of COVID, or for what is probably most frequent, sort of the gastrointestinal illnesses like norovirus, where these are really hardy viruses. They stick to environmental surfaces. And so contact with either a person when you're shaking hands or if they touch surfaces, that's often what really drives these outbreaks. But I also just want to maybe pull back just a little. This is not unique to just cruise ships. I think probably many of us have traveled to a major resort in Florida, let's say, and have had notices about outbreaks of norovirus. And I can reflect on one particularly eventful trip we took to that resort where our kids and ultimately me too ended up with a day or two of discomfort. And so it's not just the cruise per se. It is, again, close quarters, lots of people, lots of turnover. And I think I remember, too, perhaps a national park trip where there was a large outbreak, again, with lots of people in, let's say, bathroom-type facilities with high turnover and lots of potential exposure. So it's really the common factors. Cruises ends up sort of highlighting or magnifying. Rap. Yeah. I mean, it's my wife would say it's deserved. She doesn't love cruises. I'll spill my beans there, but I do think it just magnifies those close quarters, frequent contact kind of factors.
I'm listening to the symptoms that you brought up and how easy it is to confuse them with something more common like the flu. What would you say to a family who asked that question?
So a lot of times when we think about symptoms and patterns, they help us try to figure out what might be the cause. And so a lot of times when we think about something like the flu actually has this really interesting pattern where the analogy I like to use is it kind of hits you like a sledgehammer. Patients, when they first get it, know pretty quickly, like within the span of a half an hour, that all of a sudden they feel bad. It's different than other cold viruses where you kind of start to feel crummy, then you get a fever, then you start to maybe cough or sneeze or have a runny nose. Like there's a more gradual onset with many of the others. And similarly, you know, something like norovirus, the low-grade fever and then the GI stuff tends to happen fairly quickly after you were exposed, within the first 24 hours or so. It's not days later the way it might be with others. And it's fast on, and thankfully it's usually fast off if you've got a intact immune system. But still, a day or two of vomiting and diarrhea can ruin a vacation pretty quickly. And so thinking about the onset, thinking about, you know, what the exposure might have been, are some of the clues that we use to try to help figure out what the possible cause was.
And I appreciate that but I would also say most people don't realize that. So thank you for really breaking it down and also realizing that when you do seek medical care, those details are very important to share with your provider so that they can distinguish what type of virus or what could actually be going on. You brought up norovirus, and I want to circle back to that. And one thing that maybe most people might not be aware of is that hand sanitizer doesn't actually work against norovirus. Can you explain why? And I know you mentioned one or two other ways, but what should people be doing instead?
Yeah, so hand sanitizer ethanol is really good against most bacteria and many viruses. Where it falls short are some of the viruses that have sort of a more sturdy exterior. And the ethanol concentration that's in hand sanitizer is not high enough to kill the virus. And so this is where we need good old-fashioned soap and water and the actual physical sort of rubbing and washing of your hands. In order to get rid of, let's say, a norovirus or a rotavirus or some of the other, usually it's diarrheal type viruses.
And it's interesting, you're bringing this up, and my mind is going to something that I share with patients about the different preventative measures that we use. And I try to explain to kids this way, so I'm going to share it with you. And that is that all of these different things, washing our hands, wearing a mask, and so on, about surfaces, touching our eyes and our mouth and our nose. And I would tell them that all those things are like Swiss cheese. So they may not each individually be perfect, you know, alone, but when you line up Swiss cheese, then you hold it and try to look through it, you can't see through all the holes because all of those things are important to do in order to protect yourself.
Yeah.
And they seem to understand that, yeah. You know, especially when people say, well, I don't really think masks work or so on. And I try to say, well, listen, we need all these different measures. And I do appreciate too you bringing up other trips. You know, people are going to be traveling this summer. And I know the way that there's so much fear that we see in the media, how do you help families kind of distinguish between what they should continue to do? Because certainly we don't want people to be canceling trips. How can they decide this is a trip worth going on? And also, I'm going to make it two part, but let's start with that. And then the other part is, what should they be doing to prepare for these trips? What should they bring along with them in addition to hand washing and all the things we already talked about?
Yeah. So first, I'm a big believer that I tell my parents I want you to live a normal life. That travel and exposure is really important for families, for young kids to see the world, to get a different perspective, to get out into nature. There's so many incredibly powerful things about all those experiences. That being said, I think some common sense precautions really important, and they're not that complicated. So we tend to think about again, having a couple of disposable masks with you for those events, if you can see, wow, we're heading into a crowded train station or there's a lot of people or this flight is particularly crowded and I'm just going to take a moment. We're going to mask up for a couple of hours until we get into more open air. Okay, so that's a great example. I think hand sanitizer is, again, something where if you've got the travel size and it's not going to get taken away, everybody can have a quick thing. The other thing I like is some of the airlines give you those, the wipes with alcohol. Yeah. And so I often will take two and I'll use one and keep the other one for some other time when I might need it before I'm going to eat or if I'm in a place where I just want to clean off my hands. And so I've got the emergency stash. And so that might be something that parents can consider. And then obviously the other common sense things, I know that for certain vacations, thinking about other travel precautions. So certainly depending on where you're going in the world, you're going to want to talk to a provider about whether you need special vaccines for where you're traveling. If you need to worry about things like malaria, where you have to take a preventive antibiotic ahead of time and during the trip. If there are other exposures that you have to worry about potentially in the air, potentially from mosquitoes, potentially from food. And so thinking about things like bug spray or insect repellent, depending on where you're going. All of these, I think, are common sense precautions. And frankly, they'll make your vacation better if you're not spending your whole time getting bit by mosquitoes or getting sunburn or something else.
So being prepared is the key. That's what I hear.
Sarah, just one other thing. Obviously planning a little bit ahead. So sadly, we often get the call, I'm leaving for my flight tomorrow. What can we do now?
Yes.
And that's a little too late. So you want to do it maybe a month beforehand at least, because oftentimes it takes time to get the vaccines, which often have to be a few weeks before. You might have to start your malaria prophylaxis a few weeks before your trip, depending on what you take. Planning as far ahead, making that phone call to whether it's your pediatrician or your travel medicine specialist about those exposures.
That is such great advice. And also, I want to tell people, check your immunization records and make sure that you are up to date. So if you have an older child or an adult yourself, is your Tdap, like tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, up to date, for example? I'd love to ask you about hepatitis A and travel, because I feel like that's one that may be getting deprioritized right now. Tell us about hepatitis A and the importance of that vaccine. And that one you want to do at least 6 months in advance. So when you were talking about timing, it made me think of that.
Well, so first, hepatitis A is probably one of the best vaccines that we have in terms of the fact that it actually works consistently well, has very few side effects, and potentially lasts for your lifetime. I do want to correct maybe one thing you said, Sarah, in the sense that actually it works pretty quickly. We want to have people plan ahead, and you can complete the whole series if you're not traveling over the course of 6 months. But there is an accelerated schedule that you can give up to a few weeks before your trip. And you'll need an extra dose after you come back to complete the full series. But there is a rapid one. So I want to make sure that people know that hepatitis A is something you can take care of pretty quickly in those weeks that we were talking about when you're planning your trip. Hepatitis A, if you think about it, many of the countries around the world still deal with the burden. We thankfully have been able to address our burden with widespread vaccination. It's one of those where we used to see kids getting really sick with liver failure, perhaps needing a liver transplant. I think if I talk to my colleagues here at Lurie or perhaps elsewhere around the country, they'd say we haven't had to do a transplant for hepatitis A in 20 or 30 years. It just doesn't happen anymore because we've been routinely vaccinating all kids. So think about the life-changing experience it might be if your child was that one child. Yes, thinking about it, for certain areas of the world, you get hepatitis A from contaminated food and water or contact with someone who might have recently had the virus or is a carrier of the virus. And, you know, you might go to a restaurant in a country where you're trying to enjoy the local fare, and you may not realize, but that might be the source of your illness. And hepatitis A, the symptoms can last for several months. So it's not just a day on or day off, perhaps like a norovirus is. Certainly I would talk to my patients about wanting to avoid that. And yes, your arm might be sore for a day or two, but I think that's the price I'd be willing to pay.
And I appreciate you sharing the fact that you can get a vaccine within weeks of travel. I want to mention that when my son Benjamin was in college, there was an outbreak of hepatitis A at the college, yeah, right here in the United States. And I was so grateful that he had his routine immunization. So we really want to encourage people that even if you're not planning to travel anytime soon, you know, that this is an important part of the vaccine schedule. I want to take a moment and talk about certain groups of people, kids with health conditions, immunocompromised individuals, older grandparents on a family trip. Who should be having conversations with their doctor before booking a cruise or going on vacation where they could potentially be around a lot of people?
So this is a terrific question. The short answer is all of the above, perhaps for slightly different reasons. And so, as you said, the older kids, ones who are otherwise healthy, they probably just need a review of their vaccine history. Like you said, they might need a booster of their tetanus and whooping cough vaccine. They might need an hepatitis A if they haven't had the early dosing. And so I think that's one group. Certainly, you mentioned kids with immunocompromise. We have a large group of children here with various medical conditions. They've had cancer and are getting chemo. They've had a transplant and are on an immunosuppressive medicine. They might have inflammatory bowel disease or something else where they're on a variety of medicines to suppress their immune system to control their symptoms. Those kids deserve to travel. They want to travel. They want to live a normal life. And so we often have additional precautions we advise to them, whether it's vaccines or additional medications or perhaps other physical sort of measures to avoid risk. Sometimes we do have to advise them that there are certain things that you're going to want to avoid, whether it's certain types of foods, certain water exposures, other things. But I think that conversation with perhaps an infectious disease specialist, I don't want to sound too self-serving, but I think that my colleagues and I are in a particular place to offer that kind of advice. And I know our primary care colleagues reach out to us all the time about particular advice for those patients. And then you mentioned the older family members, which I really appreciate too. I think we have come to realize that as we get older, our immune system doesn't work as well. And the analogy I use is it's kind of like older adults when they need a hearing aid because their hearing isn't as good. Your immune system is often the same way. It needs that extra stimulation, whether it's an increased volume, if you will. And so we often have to give booster vaccines or higher dose vaccines for things like flu and RSV. And we've learned that, we've always known that flu is bad when you're older. We've learned that things like RSV and whooping cough can be particularly bad for older adults too. And so there's a specific carve out of additional vaccines now we give to our older family members, and they're living longer, better lives because of it. And so I think everyone has their role to play to make sure they're caught up and take the precautions prior to this big family trip.
And I'm reflecting on this because I know I'm getting older. And so I'm sitting here thinking
so am I.
So as we wrap up today, I want you to help us think in the big picture for families that have booked their cruise or getting ready for an extended trip. What are the two or three things most important that you want them to walk away from this conversation knowing?
So one, obviously, planning ahead, thinking about each person's sort of health and role on the trip, getting as much information as you can about where you're going, potential risks and exposure, Preparing appropriately for those. And I think also communication between the various groups that are coming to make sure everyone's on the same page. I think we can recall when people were traveling and some people would mask, other people wouldn't mask, and there was a lot of conflict on these trips, right? And perhaps yeah. there's enough family drama for us on an everyday basis. This is one thing that we can avoid ahead of time. And so just a little communication about, hey, you know, we've got this one-year-old that's going to join us. Maybe they haven't had a chance to get their one-year vaccines yet, so they're a little more vulnerable, or someone might have an illness and we're trying to protect them and still have them enjoy the trip. So I think that kind of communication ahead of time rather than after you're already away can really enhance everyone's experience on this trip you're trying to enjoy together. So those are a few things I would add. And again, maybe that a stash of just-in-time supplies, masks, wipes, or sanitizer, and a few other things so that just in case you encounter the unexpected, you've got a little bit of protection with you.
Dr. Ravi, this was so incredibly helpful. Exactly the kind of conversation I know our listeners needed to hear. Whether you're headed out on a cruise, a family vacation, navigating vaccine schedules, or just trying to make sense of the headlines, I hope this episode gave you clarity, confidence to protect your family. As always, we've got you covered here on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. Stay healthy, stay informed, and let's grow up together.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.